I felt good singing in the wheelchair. I don't know why.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast with Danny Goffey of Supergrass. This was a lost interview until earlier this week and was recorded about 18 months ago before the release of his brilliant solo album, Van Goffey. Do check it out, it's packed full of good tunes and you hear about it in this interview. But you also hear the fact that Danny actually co-wrote and actually wrote on his own a lot of hits for Supergrass. He co-wrote All Right, which is obviously a classic, and songs like Sun Hits the Sky. And he's a very talented all-round musician as well as a very highly acclaimed drummer. So much so he was actually picked out as a 21-year-old by an onlooking Elvis Costello to play with him, which you actually hear about, and you hear other cheeky stories about playing with Paul McCartney, which is really funny, Tom York and Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead, as well as working with Nigel Godrich. The context of this interview and it's non-released was we actually promised an hour and a half in the studio to do this, and when we arrived we said that we found out there was no studio available, and we had to do it in a pub, and we only had 15 minutes, which was a total nightmare for me. So we did about 35 minutes in total. Danny actually commented that he really enjoyed the interviews. He'd not done an in-depth interview before, so although we got about 35 minutes, the plan was to go to Danny's house and record kind of a full 90 minute one, which we've not quite got round to yet. He's in India writing his second album, so it might still happen, but there's some really great stuff on this, so we thought we'd release it as a kind of bonus episode. At the end of the last episode, the magnificent Russ Pritchard of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, we said we were due to have Gem from Oasis up next, but he's had to postpone for very legit reasons, so we're meeting in the next couple of weeks now, so that's coming through soon. You can keep up to date with that at the Stage Left Pod on Twitter, and the Facebook and Instagram page, but it is coming. But a fun little fact for Oasis fans about this recording, I watched Danny's band record live, and on bass was Drew McConnell, who's now Liam's bassist, and he's a great player, and the slight background noise you hear in this, and there is a bit of background noise because we are in a pub, is basically Drew and the rest of Danny's band basically getting drunk in the pub waiting for Danny to finish up the interview before going to rehearsal. Upcoming episodes are with Abby Harding of the Zootons, Wolfgang Fleur of Kraft, Work, and of course Gem, and thank you to John at Arm Your Ears for tidying up some of the background sound whilst you hear some people talking in the background because they're in a pub. It's a bit of a frantic interview at times, as I was trying to cram in an hour and a half into 15 minutes, so I'm not drunk as one of my friends suggested when they listened to this. I was just rushing. In retrospect, I kind of would have approached this in a different way, given the kind of context, if I was to do it again, which hopefully we'll get a chance to do, and we'll be able to dive a bit more deeper into some of the stuff we discuss. But it's good fun. He's an extremely funny guy, very highly regarded drummer in the music industry. So enjoy the lost interview with Danny Goffey of Supergrass. Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On today's episode is the astoundingly gifted drummer of Supergrass and now frontman of Van Goffey, Danny Goffey. Today we'll find out about Danny's great new album, what it's like to be in the band Pete Doherty, the brotherhood of Supergrass, what advice Danny would give young musicians going into the industry, and about one day in December 2004, where five demigods of British music formed the greatest lineup to have never made an album to record the backing track for Band Aid 20. Joining Danny in that band were Paul McCartney, Tom York, Johnny Greenwood, under the guidance of the genius producer Nigel Godrich.
Gobridge to provide the perfect musical foundation for none other than the fucking Sugar Babes to sing Do They Know It's Christmas Time, seemingly completely unaware this was the very question listeners were asking the Sugar Babes themselves once they'd seen the calibre of the band they happened to be singing over. We'll also be asking Danny about the great singles he wrote in Supergrass, such as Called by the Fuzz, Late in the Day, All Right, which contributed to over 5 million albums sold and 15 years of sellout tours. So it's a pleasure to say our guest on the Stage Left podcast is Danny Goffey. Thanks for joining us, Danny. How's it going?
Good afternoon. I'm doing all right.
Good man, good man. So, Van Goffey, new album?
Yeah.
Happy with it?
Yeah, I think so. It was, it was a bit of a long slog. It took... I had to record it. I recorded it, basically, I played it nearly everything. A couple of people played a bit of guitars here and there and some extra piano stuff. But I just managed to get in and out of the studio, a few weeks here, a few weeks there, and it took about 18 months to make
it. Is your studio at home, or is it your home studio? Or?
It's part of Distiller, the record company that I'm signed to. They've got a really nice studio down in Somerset, but it's kind of turned into a bit of a home now, signed to the label. I think hopefully I'll be able to use it a lot more. It's got some amazing stuff in there. So,
what was the blueprint for the album when you started it? What did you want to achieve from it?
Well, I suppose the band Supergrass split up in 2010. I just sat around a bit and I sort of said hello to my kids a bit more, moved out of London, blah, blah, blah. And then I just kept writing songs, just kept walking around the house with an acoustic guitar. And then I just thought, why not? You know, I wasn't quite sure what else I should do, really. And I was living in this little village in Somerset. And just started really having it. And I converted this old sort of shed, like this kind of concrete garagey shed thing that I had right in the sort of corner. And I clad that in some wood and put a computer in there and started making some music on it. And then in between my sort of teenage kids getting off their tits in there and me making music, we had quite a good time, yeah. And it all came together then. So that was like about 18 months ago.
Yeah.
Did it, recorded it, and yeah, it's just come out a few weeks ago.
How have you found this transition from drummer to frontman?
I found it absolutely not an issue until I started playing live and then realised it's, you've got to have your sort of wits about you. What I do like is having a microphone. People can hear what I've got to say.
Yeah, but you did a lot of backing vocals in Supergrass, didn't you?
Yeah, but when I talked in between songs, you could just sort of hear this sort of like, like a monkey, or something like that. And then it was kind of a bit cabaret. Like, now I can actually articulate some things I want to say. So that's quite fun.
That's cool. What about as a band leader? Are you like the decision maker in this band, I assume? Like, how does that work? What kind of band leader? Are you democratic? Are you dictatorial?
For live stuff, yeah, you know, everyone's aware that they're my songs I wrote, you know, and they're sort of playing how they interpret these songs live a bit more. But I suppose because I sort of played stuff, you know, I started on acoustic guitar and then I write some drum parts, a bit of bass, and then build it up and the songs have changed. So I'm sort of all over it, really. It's kind of my personality, really, whole thing. But that might well change now I've got a band together, because I didn't have a band when I recorded it. I'm terrible at multitasking, so I didn't even think about playing live until it was all mixed, done, mastered. Then I had to get the band together.
Yeah.
So
cool.
Yeah.
Did you have any kind of, like, what did you consciously try to do differently on a solo record from, like, stuff you've done in the past? Was this, like, an idea you particularly had for this album, or something you didn't want to do?
Well, lyrically, I was allowed to really get over exactly what I wanted.
Yeah,
which is good. Which is a bit of humour.
Very much so.
I think a lot of the later Supergrass albums, the last couple, were sort of a bit devoid of stuff like that. And you know, some of the ideas for songs I had, kind of the others in the band would kind of raise an eyebrow and think, I don't know if I really should be singing that. That's a bit too you know.
And
it's hard for Gaz to sing what I was writing. But, you know, I suppose in the early days, like Caught by the Fuzz and stuff, we were so just spitting out stuff that it didn't really matter who wrote it, you know.
You didn't sing any lead in Supergrass, did you?
I sung a song on every album, but just one of the really weird ones that I wrote, I'd sing.
Yeah. Did you not want to sing? Because I know Mickey sang on a couple of songs as well, didn't he? Like, did you not want to sing?
I didn't, because I was such an energetic drummer.
I
just couldn't, really. I couldn't sit still and lean over and sing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, sort of a bit Keith Mooney sort of thing. Although, I don't know, did he say, I think he might have barked out a few.
Yeah.
But it didn't come into it. A three-piece, two singers, me thrashing, you know, changing time and all that stuff was exciting. I don't think there was room for me to sing. It's quite hard to sing really well playing the drums.
There's not many who've done it. Great, and did you break your leg while you were recording this album?
Yeah.
How did you manage that?
We had a football game at the studio. And
in the studio?
No, outside, on the grass. But actually, I was quite happy not to play because I was right in the middle of doing a take. And we played for about 10 minutes and I just fell over and all my weight went back on my shirt and it bent backwards and broke just above my ankle.
That stopped the whole process for a while, or was that just loads of editing
then? Stopped recording for about 2 weeks and then I was in on a wheelchair. So I did... It was quite empowering. I was in... I felt good singing in the wheelchair. I don't know why.
It's like everyone's doing stuff. You sung your vocals in the wheelchair?
Yeah. Oh, so I beat a man and Phil's dummy.
Right, I've
got some photos of it, yeah. So, it's great.
Yeah. So, single of the year, without doubt, Race for Life. For those who've not heard it, the song is a starting point in Danny's memoirs. It's like a wistful look back on a very, very, very early part of his life.
First memories.
Tell us about writing that. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, but that came from a stroll around Glastonbury a couple of years ago, I think. And I was a little bit worse for wear.
I saw you at Glastonbury dancing to Primal Scream.
Did you?
Off your tits dancing to Primal Scream a few years ago. Yeah.
God.
Yeah, it was like that 2006, might have been... something like that.
Oh, yeah. What, in front of the big stage?
Yeah.
Right.
It was second stage.
Yeah.
So, go on. So, where did Race for Life come from?
Walking
around Glastonbury.
Yeah, and I started concocting this idea of what would happen if you were all sort of little individual personalities and you're all going up. Originally in the song, there was a line in the song where it stops at the Fallopian Bar, you get a drink there, and there'll be loads of sports jocks in there and stuff. And
awesome.
And then you get them really pissed. This was the first idea. And then I basically got one of them really hammered, and then he allowed me to jump on his back, like me on little sperm on the big sperm, and he swung me all the way up to the egg. And he battered it through the egg, and just as he was getting through, I pulled out a knife and stabbed him.
Oh, wow.
On the back of the
egg.
That's
very different to how it kind of turned
and
out.
So, and then that's how, like, a complete Wally like me came to be. You know, I wasn't this strong one that burrowed through.
How come you changed it?
I don't know.
It's so good.
Couldn't get all those lyrics into little couplets.
Nice. So good.
Yeah, I like about that is like the line there were bums and murderers, thieves, gangsters.
Yeah.
I just find it really funny to think they're all this big fucking brigade of people jostling trying to get there.
Yeah.
It's kind of like life, really. Everyone fighting to get where they want to be.
I shot out of my old man shooter, summer of 73. Straight into the biological computer of me old girl's feeding machine. They told us to swim, so we got down to it. Started heading upstream in the hot pursuit of the egg white fruit and the chance of the ultimate dream, to dream of life. So get down to it. Well, I was just one of a million sons and daughters, swimming in milky waters, making a name, staking a claim to become the chosen one, the apple of an eyeball, a screaming new arrival from a testicle. The quest had just begun in the rest of life.
The song on your album called The Number 9, right?
Yeah.
Now, I listened to that, and I thought it was quite an emotional journey, like this narrative all the way through this story.
Yeah.
And then I read, how I've missed this, is it about you dating a robot? Someone said it's you dating a robot.
No,
I thought that was a metaphor. You say, satisfaction, flicked her switch and she turned on. Like, I was like...
Yeah, no, well, it is. If you listen to the lyrics, it's a... I was on the number 9.
That?
Oh, no. She got on a windmill line, 6'9", tin pan eyes.
Yeah.
So it is a weird story, but it's like... It's a bit like a sort of a modern or a futuristic take on Up the Junction.
Right, okay, Squeeze.
So it's like basically that song he goes through, he has a kid.
Yeah.
His wife leaves him and stuff like that. And it's kind of a bit of a... Yeah. You know, so like a real life story, but you've met this sort of 7-foot really beautiful robot that you have metal children with and stuff.
Absolute tune. Right, Charles of the Modern Man, big tune, single. That video, Wicker Man at the end.
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, we only thought of that as we were walking up to the field, like the end of the day. I was just going to find a tree and they were going to throw loads of crap at me. And then we had this, like, we just found this field, and it had this like round bit on it, and it was quite near my house and stuff like that. I thought it was perfect, and then it all came a bit Wicker Man-y, yeah.
Now, the lyrics to that, I'm going to take back to a quote that I read from you, which said, sometimes working freelance can be quite stressful, so occasionally you wish for a 9-to-5 job so you could leave it all behind.
Yeah.
Do you often think that, really? I mean, you've got the best job in the world, yeah?
No, the only thing, the way I said that is because when the band split up, I was kind of like just peddling, you know, and I didn't really know what was happening. I've never really took charge of my own finances for all that stuff. I got into a load of shit with how I was operating and, you know, supporting my family and how I was kind of going about it, which was just not thinking very straightly. And it's just that thing of you've got to start creating. You've got to be creative rather than, I think the saying was that sometimes you just wish you could clock off and you would get a paycheck at the end of the week and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's what's funny is those people would probably think exactly the same. It would think the opposite.
Absolutely.
So yeah. It's a weird one. Yeah. It's just there's times when everyone is like looking to the skies going, why?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
kind of it's one of them.
Another quote from you. I could be in Atlanta at 4 in the morning at a transvestite club, having such a good time that I wanted to become a tranny. Then a week later, I was at a parent-teacher evening. I never quite understood who I am and where I'm going. Right.
What a weird quote.
That's a great quote.
Is it?
I think it's a great quote. So are you still in that stage? You don't know who you are and where you're going? I mean, isn't everybody
actually,
in that stage?
Do you know what? I was writing a song yesterday called... hold on, it was called Personality Breakdown. It sounds a bit like Personality Crisis by that American band, I can't remember they're called. And it was like that. It was like you don't know if you're up and down, you don't know if you're a boy and a girl, you know. And it was kind of that thing of, it's more of people looking at you and they don't quite know who you are anymore. And man, I think it changes every 6 months. I really do. I don't really see it more than 6 months, and because I've with my family, I've moved quite a lot of houses, I've lived in a lot of places, we can move very quickly. I sometimes call my wife a bit of I wrote this song called Romany Gypsy Blood, and I think she's got a lot of it in it, because she picks up and moves, and I follow her really. So it's always a bit on the edge for me, and that I suppose relates to one day you might do something that you've never done before and you think, shit,
yeah,
this is where it's at, this is amazing, and it might just totally change your life. But
how, in the way that your career's turned out, how does that align with the ambitions you had as a kid? So when you were going into the music industry as a young person, I know you hit it big very young, didn't you? Like, how's it panned out? I mean, in comparison, is it what you thought it would be?
I loved it. I think maybe Supergrass went on a little bit longer. I think we could have probably knocked it after 4 albums instead of 6.
This good last two. I know you say it, the last two good though. Good album,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I suppose just the popularity of the band came down a bit, and maybe we saw them as a bit of a failure because they didn't sort of do as well as the others. But I suppose that's a natural thing of bands releasing a lot of albums.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's really funny because my son, Alfie, so...
He's in a video, isn't he?
Yeah, he's playing the bass in the last one, Charles, but he's in a band called Cousin, without the I. And yesterday I went for a meeting with the guy who's going to sign him, a manager. So he does dance music now. But I worked out he was exactly the same age as me when I met our managers for Supergrass, Chris and Bryce, who do Radiohead and stuff like
that. Yeah.
And it's just so, like... You know, it's just
cycle.
Yeah, it's life. What is it? Replaying itself.
But so, what advice are you giving him that you would have given yourself?
Well,
and was there anybody also? Is there anybody when you were young, maybe suggesting not going? Like, was there like pressure to not go into the music industry? Or
No. I think the only one who's probably had a bit of a say was my parents, because I was pretty young. But they were, I'd sort of either dropped out or been thrown out of two schools, and they were really happy that someone was showing me some attention. So they were quite happy to go with it. I think you've just got to go for it. You can't. I think to get. You know, it's probably really terrible advice, but to to sort of sit down too sensibly and go through everything with a fine toothpick and weigh up the pros and cons and stuff. Sometimes you just got to just close your eyes and go for it.
Yeah.
And hopefully you trust who you've met. So have a I'd say have a go to the pub and have a bit of a drink and a bender and ask lots of questions and just see how you get on. And if you come out of it thinking, I don't know if I like this person, it's not right.
There you go. And how old were you when you wrote All Right? You must be pretty young.
Well, me and Gaz wrote that together. Yeah. So I reckon we were about 19. He's 2 years younger than me, so he's about 17, 18, 19, yeah. 20. It was in my mum's... My mum's house where I might have lived at the time, I don't know, or moved out.
Yeah.
And she had an upright piano. I wrote a song called Sofa of My Lethargy.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
It's the same chords, it's alright, it's just really slowed down.
Oh, right, okay.
So, well, similar chord structure going up a tone to a minor. And we were fucking about with that song, and then Gaz suddenly just started going and doing it really fast. And we were really like, and the words just came out, the tune just came out, and we just did it instantly.
Let's talk about Caught by the Fuzz. Is that quite autobiographical? Did that happen to you? Is that an incident that happened?
That happened to Gaz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I lived in this street in Oxford called Iffley Road, and we'd come back from a pub or something, and the guy who was driving the car, one of the lights were out, so he got stopped by the police, and then they searched Gaz, and his little sort of a little tin came out that was hidden in his pants, and it just dropped on the floor, tinged, and he was like, "Hello, hello, hello, what's this?" And then he got taken away, and then, you know, a week later, nothing happened. He just got cautioned or charged for something, and I think a week later I just woke up and I used to play guitar with only the first four strings, so it didn't have the two littler strings.
Yeah.
And I was a pretty crap guitarist, but I used to make up these chords, and the chords to Caught by the Fuzz are quite weird. They're sevenths and
weird
sort of chords. They're all played at the top of the guitar, the heavier strings.
Yeah.
And then I just remember just coming out there and saying, Caught by the Fuzz.
Great tune. Yeah. Great tune. Second album, actually my favourite Supergrass song of all time, Richard III, big tune. You must miss playing that. You must miss it.
That's Gaz's, that one.
Do you call that live?
We would have recorded it sort of bass drums, maybe Gaz playing a guitar, and then we keep the bass and drum track, and he'd probably redo his guitars a bit, add some. But yeah,
when you've obviously your recording experience.
Yeah, all the drums were. I think that was down in Sawmills again. Yeah, it was the second album, wasn't it? Yeah, so yeah, it would have been a take, or maybe even it. I think that was when we were on tape, so we would have maybe spliced together some tape to make two takes into one.
Right, okay.
Or like got a really good ending from another one. It's quite funny that, because you get a razor blade and you actually cut the tape and stick it together. It's really, we used to have our hearts in our mouths every time we did it.
Actually, this leads me on to something, another quote from you, this is important, right? Because I've wondered this for years. Come On Arlene, you said it was the first record you ever bought.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a bit in the middle of that I used to always be on the dance floor at the end of a night. And when everyone else is dancing to the middle bit, I'm trying to grab the nearest drummer and go, how the fuck did they do this recording, right? And I've got a quote from you that says, this was the first record I bought when I was 8. I played it to death at full volume. When he slowed down and then completely sped up, the whole excitement that used to blow my mind, I just couldn't work out of how everyone was staying at the time. I get obsessed by things like that. Have you ever found out? Or as you've grown as a musician, have you worked out how that, you know?
I guess that band, they probably... they're sort of a folk, you know, pop folk bands. They probably just played loads and loads and loads, and then
you reckon it's
repetition? I don't think it was. It would have spliced it together, but I don't know. Actually, I might find out. You can probably find out somewhere.
Yeah, no, I did have a look. The best thing I've heard is that they like, one theory is that they're better musicians than a lot of the people are now.
Yeah. I'm sure
it wasn't overdubs. They were, you know.
Oh, it's just, you know, a geezer, the bass.
Yeah, but the way it speeds up, and the bass and the snare is so fucking. It's so good. Okay, let's go back to third album, Supergrass.
Yeah.
Great album.
Yeah.
What do you remember about recording that?
It was done at Ridge Farm in Surrey, yeah. So, I remember it. I remember actually probably just that was when I was starting to get. There was a few people getting off their tits, you know, a few people in the band were getting quite messed up. But it was mainly great memories. Just, you know,
big tunes on that album.
Yeah, we all started having, like, little kids came on the scene a bit more, yeah. And it was just a little bit more pressured than the other two, just because we were all sort of had our little families starting and things like that.
When Mick had his accident, remember that happening, very shocking, you then toured as Diamond Hoo-Ha, man.
Yeah.
For the Diamond Hoo-Ha album.
Yes.
I saw you at Madame Jojo's.
Oh, yeah.
I think you opened with Beat It.
Yeah, you probably.
So is that what kind of like, because you did a few covers that night as the two of you, is that how kind of the Hot Rats?
Yeah, it did. That is how the Hot Rats started, but that we had such a laugh on that tour. It was brilliant. It was like the first, it was a bit really refreshing. It was the first time we'd really taken the shackles off a bit and lost a lot of how do I say this? Yeah, just had a bit more freedom, you know. And it was kind of a bit more like the old days, you know, drinking a lot and having a really bit of a rock and roll tour for a few weeks.
You glammed up and everything.
Yeah, and we actually had little aliases. I was Randy, and Gaz was Duke Diamond, and we kind of stayed in those sort of in those roles through the whole tour, really. And we made a great film about it in the end. It's really great. You seen that?
No.
Oh, man,
is there a film about it?
Yeah, we made it. It's on iTunes.
I'll have a look.
It's called Diamond Hoo-Ha Men.
Oh, okay.
And it's a film of the tour.
Oh, right.
And Gaz's brother Charlie films it, and he's dressed as an ex-badminton player the whole time. It's brilliant. Do you know what? It's one of the best rock and roll documentaries there is out there.
I'll check it out. And I'm sure our listeners will too. Let's talk Hot Rats. Working with Nigel Godrich. What a legend. I know you've known him for a long time.
Yeah.
Tell me, as a producer, can you name two or three things he does that's different to any other producer, or what have you learned from working with someone like him? Or what have you learned from working with him?
Well, it was very quick, the Hot Rat stuff, you know. It was basically all done in 10 days or so, really. So it was very fast, and it was just very free, you know, but it was lent to the type of music we were doing. It was supposed to be quite live, a lot of live takes and stuff.
Yeah.
He introduced a lot of things that we didn't really use before, like stuff like the drone tracks, which are like just background noise, you know, and then you can reverse these tracks. Like we'd play one note on a violin, we're all singing and a bit of percussion and stuff, and then you can reverse it and pitch it and do stuff to it, and it's like amazing. It just adds like colours to stuff. That was really good. So yeah, I learned a lot about that, you know, different tricks of production, but you know, not a massive amount. I didn't really learn that much. It wasn't the type of record to learn from. It was a release for him after doing Radiohead, just do something really simple, really quick.
How did you approach like the fact there was no bass, like as a because it's all is that album recorded live, or is it like
mainly live? Yeah, and then it's with, you know, little overdubs of low strung guitars to sort of make a bass.
Because his stuff is like, radio stuff is so obviously bass heavy, and then to go for like no bass at all. But
I don't know, we tried not to use a bass on most of it, but we had to with little bits.
Yeah.
But to me, you know, it was okay. When I listen back to it, I'm not blown away by it. Actually.
Yeah.
You know, some of it's quite interesting, but it's a bit thin. Okay.
Yeah. Very honestly, yeah, I quite enjoyed it. Okay. Talk about working with Nigel Godrich. You worked with him on Band Day 20.
Yeah.
Tell us about that day. So you have Paul McCartney on bass.
Yeah, it's funny.
You locking in a rhythm section, Paul McCartney. Yeah. What was that like?
Well, it's funny because there's a lot of people. All through my life, I've been sort of compared a bit to Paul McCartney. People say I'm a bit of a lookalike. I don't know if I get it properly. But like even when I was on the escalator coming out the tube today to go where we're going now, and some old bird like said, she said, "Oh, you're one of them things, aren't you, from Paul McCartney?" It's like, what? You know, one of them bootlegs. And I was like, what do you mean? What, the bootleg Beatles? Yeah, that's it, all the lookalikes. And I, because they had a guitar on my back. But, you know, that happens all the time when I go to London. It's really weird. So anyway, I was in there and he'd been playing the bass and he's getting on a bit. So he had a masseur who was like giving him a little shoulder rub and an arm rub because, you know, he's over 70 and he's playing away all day. It's quite odd. And so while he was being massured, I had a beer and I was just messing about in front of him and he was sort of looking at me and I was like, yeah, I said, it's funny actually because a lot of people say I look quite like you. And he looked at me and he just went, take that as a compliment. Okay. And then I do this thing of I can do all four Beatles rolled into one in about sort of a second. I don't know if I can do it anymore. I used to
go on. So,
this is not good radio.
No.
But it was like Ringo and then George. But I had it down really well.
And did you show him that?
Yeah. And he wasn't impressed.
He wasn't impressed, no. Oh, man.
We got on really well. He told me loads of really fun stories about Hamburg.
Yeah?
Yeah, because he knew I was probably a bit of a nutter around that time, so he was outdoing me with some quite mad stories.
Really?
Hamburg. Yeah, yeah. No, I can't.
No, that's fair enough.
I'll get bloody lynched.
Yeah. What about, like, locking in the rhythm section?
He used to be peaks.
Really? Locking in the rhythm section with Paul McCartney.
Yeah, really good.
I mean, it can't be any better than that, can it, really? I mean, he's a great bass player.
It was great. And then at the... Yeah, he's brilliant. And I have a bit of trouble with speeding up and slowing down, just generally.
Okay.
I call it dynamics, and they're usually good, but some people don't like it.
Yeah.
But he was really good with that, and he went with it, but at the end of every time we did that song... I always wanted it to go do 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 do, and I could go click click ding, things like that. Beatles sort of ending of songs.
Yeah,
and he wouldn't do it, and then he did it once right at the end. We did it together.
Nice,
which was kind of like a bit of a crossing off something amazing in your life to play with Paul McCartney and do something like that. Yeah.
Lots of young musicians can be listening to this. How do you handle working with big personalities for the first time? Obviously, you're used to it now. By then, you were probably very used to it. But, you know, walking into a studio, Paul McCartney there and working with him, how do you kind of stay in the zone so you perform at your best and that kind of thing?
I don't know. It depends what, you know, you can be in all sorts of different moods. You can be a bit stressed out and find it quite hard. But I just think you've got to just be yourself in that. And I tell you, the one I was most worried about was I played with Elvis Costello in about 96.
Right, okay.
After the first album, and I think he just seen me drumming and liked it. And I had to go on my own into a studio where he was doing some album. And I found that one really hard. And I couldn't relax on that one. Because I love Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
And even at the time, I used to love him when I was 21, you know.
Yeah.
But I found that one quite tricky to sort of keep the nerves sorted. Yeah, and like I look him in the eye and, you know, that sort of thing. But I suggest maybe a couple of whiskies.
Yeah.
Before you go into some of a situation like that.
Good advice, man, good advice. And back to Band Aid 20, working with Tom and Johnny from Radiohead as well. What are they like?
Great.
You must know them from Oxford days, do you?
Yeah, yeah. We didn't really have as much to do with them growing up in the 90s. We were kind of like slightly different camps. We shared the same managers, but we see each other around a bit, and I sort of grew to know them later on, you know, more in the last sort of 6-7 years. Yeah, really cool. Tom's quite a funny guy. Johnny's brilliant. We did some work on a film called Inherent Vice.
Oh, right.
Johnny did the music, and me and Gaz did some, played as this sort of 60s band, and some of the film music of that.
He's well into his film scores now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's really good. Yeah. He works with this guy called Jean-Paul Lansing.
Yeah, yeah. He done There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, he did
The
Master.
Yeah,
and he did this new one, The Inherent Vice.
Right, okay. Oh, nice one.
And then I also worked with Nigel Godrich on Scott Pilgrim's soundtrack.
Oh, did
soundtrack.
You?
Yeah, me and Gaz did that.
Really?
With Nigel.
How did you... It's Scott Pilgrim, right? That's quite different, isn't it?
Yeah.
So is that actually writing songs for it, or actually writing...
No, just bits of stuff and some weird little melodies and sort of weird stuff. And just spent a few days with Nigel just freaking out, making weird music.
Okay. He's one of the most sought-after producers, man, so I hope you realise that.
He's a really, really great guy as well, really funny, likes a drink, it's good fun.
Do you know when they released Band Aid 20, right, it was released, that the first time it was shown was on The X Factor, right, because it was the exclusive, and when it got to, they said to the judges, what do you think of this? Like, someone would go, yeah, it's a great thing for charity, Sharon Osbourne, yeah, this is brilliant, you know, it's going to raise loads of money and that kind of thing. Got to Louis Walsh and he fucking slagged off the production on it. And it's like in front of like 20 million viewers or whatever. He's just like Nigel Godrich has been taken down on his production with fucking Louis Walsh. I hope he recovered from that, because
do you know what though, to be really honest, I don't think Nigel was that proud of it. And it was a funny one, because we had to just... It's really hard getting a lot of personalities in a room together like that. And I reckon on the first one, it sounded probably a bit better, to be honest. Because it was just more locked off. This was a lot more free form.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was slightly more, I suppose, a bit more sort of indie rock or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So to Louis Walsh, it was probably wet or something, you know, not really pop-tastic.
So there you go, that was the lost interview with Danny Goffey as a bonus for our listeners. It was at that point that Danny's manager walked over and told us they had to go and rehearse for a gig they were playing the following Monday, which I went to, which was really great, in Camden. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to tweet us what you think at The Stage Left Pod. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/The Stage Left Podcast, and check out our Instagram page as well for a load of behind the scenes stuff. For further episodes, you'll be able to find them at The Stage Left Podcast website, and you've got the likes of Russ Pritchard and Mikey Rowe from Gallagher's High Flying Birds, Aziz Ibrahim on his time in the Stone Roses, where he plays through some of the guitar parts that he had to learn for being in the Stone Roses. We've got John Woff from the 1975, Grammy Hall of Famer Steve Cropper, an absolute legend, and Tony Visconti, of course, on recording David Bowie's final album Black Star, as well as another 30 odd episodes on there for you to enjoy. So we'll see you next time.